Well, we're going to start off the Media Beat today, of course, with David Tarachuk. David has his own website, themediabeat.us. He works for PBS, Ethics and Belief, as a matter of fact. And ethics and belief. I'll use the word ethics because I'll be honest with you, I have tried so hard to avoid talking about this next person, but I can no longer go.
I wonder who you have in mind. It's always good to be joining my perspicacious partner, Marshall Miles, as I report in again from the media capital of the world, New York City. But what have you got in mind in the ethical field?
George Santos.
Oh, it's very hard to hear or say that name without getting a little contorted into giggles almost. What now, I could ask, I suppose.
Well, he's so unimportant in the big scheme of things. Everybody knows who he is, what he is, and they knew it before the election. They didn't know it quite as much as they know now. And now some Republicans really behind the scene are trying to put together a way to make him resign. He's got even more legal issues as he continues to do public interviews and continues to spread lies. It reminds me, David, I don't know if you ever heard this. My grandmother used to say when we were children, you're digging a hole for yourself, keep digging, and you're going to wind up in China. This, you know, he makes it worse for himself. He makes the House look foolish. He makes the Senate look foolish. He makes politicians look bad. And this has no place to go.
That wouldn't be such a hard thing to do anyway. But I think he is an instance of, a kind of off the wall instance of a kind of exaggeration, I suppose, of some tendencies which we do associate with politicians. You know, they all tend to, I say they all, it's not fair, but many of them tend to aggrandize themselves. And what we've got here is a total fabulist. He's tipped over the edge into the incredulity that we would normally reserve for tall tales of the most ridiculous kind. I mean, he's a walking tall tale. And as you say, it seems as if he cannot help himself. So I guess we can all just cross our fingers and hope that whatever moves are necessary to get him out will succeed. On the other hand, the Republicans, as we know, don't exactly have a substantial majority in the House, and regrettably enough, for the moment, he's important to that. It's clearly been the main reason that there haven't been any substantial moves against him, as you would expect them there to have been from the get-go. We haven't seen them.
Well, all I could say is that he makes other politicians, no matter whether it's current politicians or politicians of yesteryear, look like George Washington. It's so embarrassing to America that I'll stop talking about it now. But amazed.
I'll put a period at the end of that sentence for you, if you like, which is that my European colleagues are absolutely stunned by this. I know they've had their fair share of untoward political leaders, and some terrible things have been done and said by some terrible people in the politics of Europe. But this one just about takes the biscuit for them. How could you, they say, how could you put up with this as an American citizen? And I say, well, he's very close to my congressional district, but not close enough for me to be able to vote him out. And anyway, he can't be voted out until next time. Maybe there's a way of forcing a special election, and that's maybe what we could hope for at some point.
All right, and
once he's removed, of course, there would have to be a special election. Yeah.
The second person that I didn't want to talk about, but this once again is just dragged on, and that is the murder trial. What's your feeling on that?
I am not a great fan of ongoing crime coverage. I think it's important. You know, justice has to be done and also seen to be done. The media has a role here, but I guess my main feeling is that it's way too much coverage. And I know it's exciting and titillating, but I'd rather it wasn't given quite so much time and so many column inches in the print media.
All right, I've bared my soul now, and hopefully I don't have to mention these two very, very dark segments that are going on in the United States. And there's far more important things to talk about, especially when it comes to the worldview.
Yeah, it's a week to be considering international news, Marshall. You're right. I mean, not least the headlines from the G20, that name so beloved amongst headline writers for its brevity, mainly. G20 means just a group. That's what the G stands for. That's all. Of the world's 20 most powerful countries, powerful in that together they make up the vast majority of the world's wealth. 85%, in fact, of global economic output comes from these 20. And this year, it's and this week, of course, because you know the big news has been coming out of the first of the meetings of G20 for first major meetings of the G20 for 2023. It's the turn of India to host it, so it's all happening there. And in particular, the host is, you know, in particular and in person, the host is its nationalistic-minded Prime Minister Narendra Modi. And also, it's an opportunity, I would say, for journalists and the news-consuming public too, to see that the world isn't always to be viewed through American or Western world lenses. For instance, this is one important thing I think to register with the way that foreign ministers' summit has been going. To much of the world, the Ukraine war, vital though it is, isn't the only international problem crying out for a solution. The theme that the Indians have emblazoned across all of this year's various events at various levels of government, which will culminate, of course, in a top leaders summit in the fall. The theme is one earth, one family, one future. The emphasis the Indians want, or say that should be on tackling the environment and global poverty. And of course, I think they recognize that maybe this is an over-optimistic slogan. But one thing is clear, though it's not greatly highlighted in a lot of American coverage, that many countries are not taking sides in the Ukraine war, which for many Western countries, of course, is the big issue. And those countries who are not taking sides, they're in that division of the world economy that has over time had, well, it had varyingly fashionable labels among journalists, especially the third world, the developing world, the underdeveloped world, sometimes more bluntly, the poor world. Nowadays, the kind of technical sounding global south. Even though that's geographically questionable, India, for instance, is decidedly a leading part of that global South world, but it's in reality well north of the equator. And the summit, of course, this week was at foreign minister level, as I say, and there's lots of formal rhetoric at that level, and that's easily reported on public speeches on the record. But also, we should note, since American reporters especially pounced on this, there was a brief confrontation on the sidelines, unscheduled and informal, between the United States Secretary of State, Tony Blinken, and Russia's Foreign Minister, Sergei Lavrov. It's the first time they've met since Lavrov's boss, Vladimir Putin, launched his invasion of Ukraine. The two spoke to each other one-on-one, or at least with interpreters alongside them. And unlike public speeches from a rostrum, reporters now, of course, have had to piece together what was said in this meeting from official. The briefings have come from officials on both sides telling them what went on in this exchange. And of course, Blinken himself held a press conference later that night. So we can draw some conclusions. The talk, if that's what it was, lasted about 10 minutes. That much we can know. It's a fact verified independently. But as for the content of the meeting, in the words of an experienced BBC diplomatic correspondent I know and heard on this issue, words are spoken, but there wasn't much communication. I'm sure that's true. It was unsurprisingly just a restatement of existing positions on each side. But the US State Department, importantly, I think, is letting it be known through journalists mainly that they see it helpful that there can be even such a, it can even be such a direct exchange as this when a war is going on. I guess we can perhaps paraphrase Winston Churchill. It's good that we can jaw, even in the middle of war.
Well, what's interesting about what's going on in Europe and around the country over the war in Ukraine is that the Ukrainian president was right. This is a world war. Ukraine has just, what's happening in Ukraine with Russia has brought the world either heavily in favor of the, you know, the European and United States and NATO, or the people and the countries that back Russia, and the substantial governments that are sitting on the sideline. It has put the world in a much more dangerous place. Even if you live on the tip of South Antarctica, you know, this war is going to have an effect on everybody.
Sure. And I would say that that even those people from the global south have been making the point in India that there are more important things perhaps than even the Ukraine war. But when they cite, for instance, global poverty, one of the issues that they are having to address, like in particular the rocketing price of food for many people in the global south, a lot of the blame for that can be put firmly on the shoulders of Vladimir Putin launching his invasion, because it's played havoc with the world supplies of grain. But it's true, I think, and I think you're right to see it in those terms that you express, because I noticed that the Chatham House, it's the familiar name for what in London is formerly called the Royal Institute for International Relations, they had a session which I was hoping to attend but couldn't. But I was very struck by the name that they were going to put on this event, with experts sharing their views and trying to work out potential diplomatic settlements for the future. They called it Vladimir Putin's War Against Everyone, which isn't a bad name for it.
Absolutely. We're speaking once again with the David Tarachuk, as we do on Friday mornings, taking a look at the media and the media beat. And what's interesting, and these are some headlines I've been mentioning to some friends, the good thing about me sitting and working out of my studio at home is the fact that I'm reading a lot more newspapers, a lot more commentary, a lot more writers that have actual beats like the old days. But one thing I don't understand, and that is the Department of Justice, which used to be highly regarded in this country, not by everybody, but it had a favorable rating. The Department of Justice is put in the position now where, once again, they have made comments and they're pushing back against the former president. His claims of presidential immunity for January 6th in a speech that Donald Trump just gave. Once again, Donald Trump is a lot like the first person, I'm not going to mention his name, that we talked about. Donald Trump can say things because he has diehard supporters. 33 to 35% of Republicans identify themselves as solid Trump people, no matter what. But still, the tarnish that this is putting on the Department of Justice, now the Supreme Court, it's already put the tarnish on the Senate and the House. I mean, this is really bad that our Department of Justice comes out on the weird end of this, where it should be anybody who lies to the Department of Justice.
Yeah, and journalistic coverage of this is made very awkward. I don't want to say that journalists' jobs should be easy, but then there is a particular difficulty when you're dealing with stories now that pit Trump and the Trumpists against an institution like the Justice Department. Merrick Garland, the Attorney General, is trying to tread a very careful line, avoiding the politicization of the Justice Department that people on certain wings of our political life are trying to claim is happening and that he's responsible for it. And when you report this as a journalist, it's tempting to do one of those classic journalistic cases of saying, on the one hand, on the one hand, you have this argument, and on the other hand, you have this counter argument. That doesn't really wash in these cases, and it means that the journalist's job is essentially to screen out the lies. That's a really important part of the job, and just report what's going on, what the attempt is that's being made here. The assault, the very frequent assault, being launched against a judicial process. Not just about the election results of 2020, looking retrospectively, and the grand jury hearings that have been into that, and some still continuing, but in general, the sense of having any kind of legal reckoning at all for January the 6th, for instance, this is a process that needs to be respected and reported on accurately, of course, and bearing in mind the important principles that we all hold to and should hold to as journalists, like respecting the innocence of people, the presumption of innocence for people until they're found guilty, and all of that. But I'm saying that it's particularly difficult with the inevitable politicization of the atmosphere around the Justice Department and its processes right now. I would make a comparison with the international situation at the moment. There's one part of it which is particularly fraught, and you and I have taken time in several recent broadcasts to ensure that we don't forget the serious buildup of tensions and outright violence in Israel, and of course the Israeli occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem too. And now it's definitely in the absolute forefront of the tension, since Benjamin Netanyahu's government, the most right-wing in Israel's 75-year history, is now facing uprisings of people with radically different agendas. We've had Jewish settlers rampaging through a Palestinian town, Huwara, near Nablus, setting fire to it, shooting at least one man dead. This was compounded by a senior member of the Netanyahu administration, Bezalel Smotrich. He piled in on this, saying that the town in question should be wiped out, that the state should be doing that wiping out as a matter of policy. Now, these vigilantes, so that's what they are, were avenging, they said, the Palestinian killing of two young Jewish brothers. Now, responsible voices among the Israeli authorities have been condemning the settlers for what they call taking the law into their own hands. That's just not on. And some indeed were arrested. They've been allowed to go free now with ankle bracelets until they can come to trial. And of course, in general terms, the rising background tension continues, despite attempts in talks hosted by neighboring Jordan, for instance, to dampen down the overall spiking in Arab-Israeli attacks. But meanwhile, and this is where the legal questions come in, Bibi himself, if I can use his nickname, Bibi is reported to be using the word anarchy to describe the other uprising or rioting that's going on, that these are Israelis who are horrified at the Prime Minister's attempts to limit the power of the country's independent judiciary, along with, of course, what's seen as an inevitable strengthening, consequently, of his own administration as the executive arm of government. The government's response to these massive protests has been to use stun grenades and water cannons for, in the words of the broadly non-partisan Times of Israel, the very first time these have been seen at Israeli demonstrations. Now, Bibi's angry response was probably heightened, and why wouldn't it be, by protesters besieging the salon where his wife was having her hair done. Reporters couldn't resist that detail, of course. But the Times of Israel is also reporting prominently alongside this coverage of those protests and the tough official clampdown, a remarkably strong assessment by the countries that this country's, the Israeli state attorney general, that Netanyahu himself should withdraw from the attempts to change the judiciary, as long as he, the prime minister himself, is facing criminal trial on charges of corruption. He's refusing to withdraw, of course. The word shameless comes up a lot in this coverage. You won't be surprised to know.
Yeah, and what we're talking about media. The media has got a complex issue that they're still dealing with 3 years after coronavirus came about. Our government, the different agencies in our government, can't seem to come to a consensus about how this started. The FBI now gets into the fray by the director saying that the Bureau believes COVID-19 most likely originated in a Chinese government-controlled lab. The White House said there's no consensus across the government on the origins. This just puts more doubt into people's minds about the disease, the origin of the disease, and the way our politicians have handled it.
Yeah, doubt is the main word here, the key word. The Wuhan findings amongst, amongst United States agencies with varying degrees of confidence. They all, choose a level of confidence when they give these reports. And you may ask why they bother to make public judgments which have a low degree of confidence. But anyway, that's what's happened in at least one case. In the judgment that the pandemic started in Wuhan's laboratory and not in that city's animal market is arrived at by the Energy Department, an interesting department to be in charge of this issue, this health issue, and as I say, with low level confidence. I mean, to be fair to the Energy Department, it's a responsibility that they have in fact inherited, because initially the Energy Department was responsible for research and nuclear weapons, and spinning off from that were other weapons of mass destruction, including biological weapons, and thus the laboratory expertise has been built up. But their low confidence judgment, published at last weekend, was followed only a couple of days later by the FBI director, Christopher Wray, in an interview with Fox News, interestingly, and not the main subject of the interview, almost a throwaway it came as, which is rather peculiar, but in its phrasing was substantially stronger than the Energy Department's low confidence. Only he was saying it was most likely that the pandemic started at the laboratory and not in the market. And the White House, meanwhile, is saying that there's no, something that's obviously very evident, that there's no consensus among United States intelligence agencies on this matter. And that, of course, is not surprising. You remember that China itself has been strikingly unhelpful about allowing any real investigation by outsiders. And this could all prompt a note for us to make in our editorial calendar, Marshall. Next week, the Director of National Intelligence, Avril Haines, will be giving evidence to the US Senate about threats to the nation, including, of course, viral epidemics. And I think she's going to be certain, she will be certain to face questions closely from the senators then. We can pay close attention to that, I think.
And I want to wrap up on what I consider a high point, and that is for years, NASA was just had the highest reputation in this country. And then after several mishaps involving not the program, but individual decisions that turned out to be incredibly disastrous, NASA really fell from its high place. And now recently, when they added a private company, and whether you like Elon Musk or not, it doesn't matter, but their combination of working with SpaceX has turned everything around. People once again are going to these launches. It's a can't miss. I did watch the launch that went off the other night with the four astronauts, and I think it's an incredible turnaround for an organization that really was solely responsible for itself, to be working now in a government and a private partnership that has been successful. And as a matter of fact, more companies are now working with NASA, launching more satellites. 29 different launches now in this year since January 1st, with different companies launching objects into space from this country. I just think it's a good sign that you can take such an established organization like NASA, combine them with private industry, and they are back on top where people are respecting what they're doing.
Yeah, I think it's in some ways it's a forceful assertion or reassertion of something that's gone somewhat unemphasized for a long time. The importance of government and private industry working hand in glove. I know President Eisenhower is credited with the phrase "the military industrial complex" in a negative way, but in fact there are great strengths to the American economy in the combination of the public and private sector, and that's what we're seeing now. And it's, I just think on a point of a generational point, in a way, those of us who grew up with the moon landings and so on can perhaps feel a little sense of deja vu coming around again. The some popular enthusiasm for the space effort that's going on now is kind of laudable, even if only nostalgic for people of our age.
Well, if it can bring people who like Donald Trump together and other people to be proud of something that goes on, it's definitely a good thing.
Almost a miracle, I would say.
Absolutely. Well, David, it's always great to talk with you. We'll see what happens in the next week with the media and the coverage of the many events around the globe.
Absolutely. Look forward to next week. Bye-bye now.